Today is August the 5th, 2020. What time is it? It's time for the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet as well as pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Time and the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. The personal computer business for the masses began in late 1974 with the advent of the Altair 8800 from MITS. There were many pioneers that made significant contributions to the personal computer technology that we use today. They are the unsung heroes. One of the pioneers of the modern computer interface has passed away. The New York Times reports that William Bill English died on July the 26th from respiratory failure at the age of 91. Alongside Douglas Engelbart at the Stanford Research Institute, English helped develop the first computer mouse and put together a 1968 motherboard demos that outlined many concepts that would come to PC over the decades, such as graphical user interfaces, online text editing, video calls, and hypertext links. There were major milestones in the personal computer business that you can easily identify with. The Altair 8800 was a microcomputer designed in 1974 by MITS and based on the Intel 8080 CPU. Interest grew quickly after it was featured on the cover of the January 1975 issue of Pop Electronics and was sold by mail order through advertisements. There in Radio Electronics and in other hobbyist magazines. Then there was Gary Kildor that demonstrated the first working prototype of CPM, Control Program for Microcomputers, in Pacific Grove in 1974, together with his invention of the BIOS, or the Basic Input-Output System. Kildor's operating system allowed a microprocessor-based computer to communicate with a disk drive storage unit and provided an important foundation for the personal computer revolution. Then came the early 1980s. The IBM personal computer, commonly known as the IBM PC, is the original version of the IBM PC compatible computer design. It is IBM model number 5150, and it was introduced on August the 12th in 1981. It was created by a team of engineers and designers directed by Don Estridge in Boca Raton, Florida. Well, that brings us to 1983, and that was when Joe and I and Dave Burstein, the first broadcast of the Personal Computer Show was August the 4th of 1983 on WBAI-FM New York, and it continued through January the 2nd, 2019. We started with PRN.FM with the Personal Computer Show beginning in September 7th, 2016. And where we go from here, we'll talk about later. But as I promised everyone, I'm going to get Joe King back on the air and, hey Joe, take the mic.
Good evening, Hank. You know, very recently I relocated from the Big Apple to the small cactus. By that I mean the northern part of Arizona, the part that they call the high desert. It's very strange. I would not call it a desert. I've got trees and plants and all sorts of things growing. But nevertheless, the humidity is non-existent on average. Since I've been here, it's been 10 or 12%. Nevertheless, I was unpacking the other day, filling out the shelves in what I amusingly call my studio. And I came across a box of CDs, hundreds of them, it looked like, Most of them were not labeled. I threw one into the player, and I found it was a recording back from 1980, maybe 4 or 5, and it started me thinking, when did the personal computer show start, and how did I get involved in it, and where is it today? It's an interesting problem that came about. A fellow named Jeremy Shapiro, back in 1983, perhaps 1984, called me up one day and said, look, I got a great job in Alaska. I said, how can you have a great job and be in Alaska? Those seem to be mutually exclusive. He said, no, not at all. I'm developing a college without walls for the University of Alaska. You know, up here it's pretty hard for people to get around. And I started to think just now, my God, after 30 or so years, nothing has changed. Hank, you've been developing things without walls because the coronavirus, the COVID-19, is keeping people away from schoolrooms and gatherings. I know that the New York Amateur Computer Club now does it remotely, without walls, if you will, using Zoom. And I started thinking, Jeremy called me back in the 1980s because he had set up the idea of a personal computer show with a guy named Dave Metzger, who was the programming director of a very left-wing station called WBAI. I was familiar with BAI, and it had done some really amazing stuff with live radio and music and comedians, and I was interested in it. So I went up to see him, Dave Metzger, that is, thinking I would discuss a program with him. Instead, he said, so I've booked you in for Thursday of this week to do your first show. Wow, I hadn't even thought about a show, much less a first show. So I came back, and there was, I was one of the founders of the KPRO Users Group. For those of you old-timers, KPRO was one of the first all-in-one computers that was being sold, and I was one of the early buyers of it. I recall my serial number was in the low 5,000s. Be that as it may, that's how I met Hank, you, and a few other people. Ross Greenberg, the late and missed Ross Greenberg, was with me in the KPRO Users Group, and there were two or three other key people. And within a matter of weeks or maybe months, we had built it up to a 200 membership. The KPRO was selling well, but nobody really knew anything about it or how to use it. So at any rate, I came back. At that time, Dave Metzger was the director of programs or program director at BAI. Dave Burstein was an officer, perhaps even the president at that time, of the New York Amateur Computer Club. Hank, you were a founding member. There were others. But I came to you and I said, Jeremy Shapiro set this thing up. You went, what do we do? And he said, you, Joe, have a good voice, so you'll be the host. And I'll be there every night with you in case somebody asks a question that you can't answer. And Dave Burstein said he would be there just as a fill-in the voice and to help out. And Ross said, hey, I can be the engineer. I used to engineer when I was at SUNY out in Long Island. And that's how the start of the personal computer show came on Thursday. We all showed up at the live studio, And we found out that we were preceded on the air by Gary Null, and we were followed on the air by somebody else. And we started week after week doing this thing. They switched us to Sunday night. They switched us to Wednesday, I think Tuesday, and then Wednesday. And over the years, as I said, Ross had passed on, and we got another engineer, a fellow, a wonderful guy, who had a really weird name, Stevie Deeby. It turned out his name was Stephen Jackman, and he was, at other times, not being an engineer, he was being a professional DJ and musician. That's why Stevie Deeby came about. Dave went on to other things. As I said, Ross passed on. Pretty soon, Hank and I were the only two originals, but there were others who came in. We opened up a website, and we needed a webmaster, and we got a volunteer from the listening audience. His name, you've heard before, was Michael Horowitz, and he's been with us ever since. I'm no longer really with us, Hank, because I'm out here in the high desert, and you're there in the low islands of Flushing. But we talk. Thank God for a guy named Alexander Graham Bell, so that we can talk a lot on the telephone. But we also can talk on the computer. Zoom is one of the ways that we can talk face-to-face, and face-to-face is another way. But let's get back to what we were talking about. But talking about the origins of the personal computer show. And we did pretty well. We invented something for WBAI that they hadn't really had before. We talked to them about fundraising. I didn't know much about fundraising for a radio station, nor did Hank. But we did know about using premiums, both for club membership and for other things. And we talked BAI into letting us use computer programs and other computer interest things in order to raise money for the station. And it was not unusual for us to raise thousands of dollars during a single marathon, fundraising marathon, membership drive, if you will. But pretty soon, year after year, going back to the same listeners and their children and their grandchildren, asking for money, begging for money, it became harder and harder and harder to raise money. The show was still very interesting. We had wonderful guests, people that you may have heard of, but back then in the 80s and 90s were pretty unknown. You know, people whose names today don't mean so much. You know, Bill Gates was on with Hank one night, with the head of various companies. Hank, I can't remember their names. Why don't you interrupt right now and tell the audience who was the president of the DBase software company and not Android, but the PDF programs like that. Everything was new. Every name was new. People were anxious to get on the radio because they knew that the heavy hitters bought their programs. But what about the general computer audience out there, people who only saw computers at their office or in their businesses? And this was a good way for them to reach them. So they did just that. And one of the things that we did, you know, the very first show that we did, Hank, was in 1984, and there was a guy named Ryder McClure who had just done a book on a word processor. I think it was WordPerfect, but it might have been one of the others. And what happened was so many people called and wrote and left messages. They had questions they wanted answered, that we realized that we had to change what we had thought was the format of the program to a call-in radio show. So the first half was interviews, news, things like announcements. But the second half hour became the most important part of the show, Hank. As you know, that's where we let the audience call in. And the audience did indeed call in. We thought we would have trouble getting a half hour's worth of phone calls, but we always hung up the radio show with maybe a dozen people waiting to call in. Very often they wrote in and we always tried to answer them, but we didn't always succeed, but we tried. At any rate, the personal computer show grew and it became a major show on WBAI, very often being the lead show of Wednesday night or Thursday night or whenever we ended up being on. But in the meantime, a guy named Gary Null, who is a health food nut, if you would, but he was also a lead member of the WBAI programming, opened up a thing called PRN. PRN-FM was a internet radio station, not a broadcast station, and many of the people who were on BAI did a show, again, non-profit, non-commercial, on PRN, and we were invited to go over there and do a show, and we did a show very, very similar to what we had on BAI for a long time. As a matter of fact, it was the same show we had on BAI. We just rebroadcast it on PRN. And then things changed at BAI. Management changed, audience changed, other things changed. And they pretty soon decided that computers were not something interesting to them, had nothing to do with politics, it had nothing to do with socialism, it had nothing to do with BAI. And they asked us to move on. And Hank moved on to PRN. Instead of it being a co-broadcast, it was the unique originating broadcast. I moved on also, leaving New York for the third or fourth or fifth or sixth time in my life. We moved out here to the high desert, which incidentally is absolutely a gorgeous place. Living in a desert, I always thought would be grim. Just the opposite. It's vital and fascinating and just beautiful. Hank, I hope you come out to visit with me. I have a studio, really. It's got a telephone in it. It's got a computer in it. And it's got a recorder. Well, if you call Tascam a recorder. So if you, and it has an extra bedroom, has two extra bedrooms. So if you want to come out and stay in one of the bedrooms, escape from the disgusting COVID-19 that's floating around Flushing and other places, come on out. You're always welcome here. And if you want to bring some of your listeners with you, just give me some advance notice. This is Joe King. I hope to talk to you again by way of a recorder or in person someday. Good night. Thanks for listening to me.
Thank you, Joe. Joe is adjusting to the Arizona weather. He lives in Yavapai Hills, which is a part of the Metropolitan Prescott in Yavapai County, Arizona. It has an estimated elevation of 5,354 feet. Hey, that's 1 mile above sea level. We will be hearing more from Joe in future broadcasts. When we first started, we thought it would be fun to just give it a try. We had no idea if there was an audience. Well, we have just completed 37 years on the Personal Computer Show. Tonight, we begin the 38th year. In the beginning, we had interviews with a guest from one of the then many startup hardware and software companies that created the beginnings of the personal computing industry. These companies wanted to hear from what the listeners of yesterday wanted in personal computing. That indeed is very different from today. We had telephone call-ins from listeners who had tech problems to be resolved and points of views to be expressed. The Personal Computer Show has since evolved over time, and we now have a handful of giant techs. Much of the major tech news is under the radar, as the giants in social media are using algorithms to determine what is or is not relevant. Hey, algorithms are built by human beings, and that means there is bias, or there can be bias. The show has evolved, and we have changed with the listening audience that are more interested with the use of a product and less with troubleshooting a problem with the product. Just to add to Joe's memory, we now have associate contributors as part of the show. At present, we have Marty Winston covering home automation and Benjamin Rockwell covering the IT Pro series. We have had Dr. Alfred Poor with wearable technology, David Perry with cybersecurity, and Joe Rejeski on quick tips and tricks. Many have asked whether or not the Listener Coin segment will return. I'm working on it. Listeners can email me what topic they want discussed, along with a telephone number and the time of day they can be contacted. I am working on being able to have the use of a broadcast studio covering most of the day to call back the listener to record the conversation for playback. But until the pandemic is at its end to enable us to enter a studio, the listener coins will have to wait. So where are we today? Well, I'm still active and I have no plans on stopping yet. So I'm going to be like an energized bunny. I'm going to keep going and let's see where it goes. And at some point in time, all good things come to an end. And when it does, I'll know it. Mysterious packets of seeds have been received in all 50 states. During the past week, people have been receiving mysterious packages of seeds in the mail from China. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has begun to identify the mysterious seeds that have been mailed. The mysterious, unsolicited packages of seeds supposedly being sent from China to homes across America, prompting agriculture departments in all 50 states to issue warnings against planting them. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has begun to identify the mysterious seeds that have been mailed to the United States from China, and anyone with unsolicited seeds is urged not to plant them and to alert local officials. The USDA said in a statement that 14 different species of seeds have been identified so far. They have identified 14 different species of seeds, including mustard, cabbage, morning glory, and some of the herbs like mint, sage, rosemary, lavender, then other seeds like hibiscus and roses. They include seeds of flowering plants, herbs, and vegetables. Based on information provided by constituents, the packages were sent by mail and may have Chinese writing on them. All contain some sort of seed packet, either alone, with jewelry, or another inexpensive item. The USDA explained in a statement on its website that it did not have any evidence that the seeds are something other than a brushing scam, where people receive unsolicited items from a seller who then post false customer reviews to boost sales. The USDA is currently collecting seed packages from the recipients and will test their contents and determine if they contain anything that could be of concern to U.S. agriculture or the environment. There are concerns that seeds may have been coated with something, possibly insecticide or fungicide, that could damage crops. People have described that the seeds are coated with something purple, but it appears an awful lot like seed treatment. It is warned the packages could contain harmful invasive species or be otherwise unsafe, according to a release. Invasive species are organisms not native to a certain region. The introduction of invasive species could cause the destruction of native crops, introduce diseases to native plants, and could be dangerous to livestock. An invasive plant species might not sound threatening, but these small invaders could destroy agriculture. Back on July the 15th, the Personal Computer Show from the Tech Corner, I reviewed the Credit Karma tax preparation application. I said it is the functionally equivalent to the TurboTax Home and Business Tax Prep application. I had recommended a heads up and suggested that you visit the Credit Karma website to get familiar with its free offering for next year. I was not able to print one of the required forms for submission because TurboTax did not have the finalized form. TurboTax recommended that I just submit the return with the form marked not finalized. With just 2 days before the July 15th deadline, I decided to give Credit Karma, well, a try, and if I came up with the same problem, then I would go back to Plan B, which is to submit the return via TurboTax. It took a little bit over 2 hours to manually enter the data. I was pleasantly surprised that Credit Karma had been able to print out the finalized form. The two companies' generated returns matched up with a difference of just $1. In TurboTax, you can enter the actual amount to the cents. In Credit Karma, they rounded each entry item to the nearest dollar. At the outset of the COVID-19 pandemic, what flew under the radar was news that Intuit was buying out Credit Karma for $7.1 billion. That's with a capital B, $7.1 million. Intuit is the parent company of TurboTax. $7.1 billion for a company that only had $1 billion in revenue? That seems overpriced. The U.S. Department of Justice is concerned about possible antitrust issues if Intuit, the owner of TurboTax, QuickBooks, and Mint is allowed to take over a former rival that offered free tax preparation tools that were directly in competition with Intuit's own offering. The DOJ lawyers are apparently concerned about the influence that Intuit's purchase of Credit Karma will have on consumer tax preparation platforms and the software market. Currently, the DOJ has requested Intuit and Credit Karma to provide more information before it rules on whether it to allow the merger to go through. Now, at this point, that if you happen to agree that it is in violation of antitrust, don't just sit there. I recommend that you request that the Department of Justice reject this merger. Credit Karma was founded in 2007, and the company made its mark offering services like free credit checks. But in 2017, it made one of the biggest expansions yet, adding free tax filing to its list of services. That made it a potential threat to companies like Intuit, which controls roughly two-thirds of the tax preparation market and makes billions of dollars a year providing tax filing services to Americans. TurboTax has come under fire for hiding its free file service before, and they really have been skirting the fact that they really have been restricting people who do qualify to file for free service. TurboTax and other major tax companies like H&R Block already offered free filing options for years thanks to the IRS Free File program, which promises free tax filing for anyone with an adjusted gross income of $69,000 or less. However, in the case of TurboTax, they don't look at the $69,000. If you happen to need a certain form, and if you need it, you didn't qualify. In exchange, the IRS promised it wouldn't create its own free tax product. By the way, for its part, Intuit refuted the idea that the merger is about eliminating competition at all. Then why are they acquiring Credit Karma? Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Work From Anywhere versus Rotating Shifts.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time for us to talk business. It's time for us to talk about the workplace and IT and a lot of the different things that are going on. This is where I give you my current and past experience of being a 30-year IT professional. And some of the things that I will talk about are very current. This one, this particular topic right now, I want you to think about the entire work from home. No, scratch that. I heard a new term recently that really, really rocks. It's work from anywhere. It is a grander scheme than the idea of work from home. Let's talk about this for just a moment. Going forward, where we're at right now, yes, a lot of us are working from home. The reason why we're working from home is because most of the Starbucks are closed. You can't sit in a local Starbucks, a local coffee shop, because, yeah, they don't want you hanging around for an hour or two or three while you're working. So this is only going to happen for so long. We are going to eventually escape our current situation, and we're going to move in a different direction. We're going to go back to public. It's going to take us a while for us to restore our place in non-separated society. So work from anywhere. We are going to work from anywhere. A lot of us, the concept of being in the office that we've worked with this for so many decades is now going to be just eliminated as the companies realize that working from anywhere is a great perk. I think it's an awesome perk. The ability to go into the office when you want to, that's great. The ability to work from home when you want to, the ability to go, to the local coffee shop. It's great. Now, the rest of this topic, though, is more along the lines of something that we're dealing with right now, with some companies working out different return-to-work situations. And some of the different things, and I haven't been following the CDC guidelines, the official guidelines of exactly what we're supposed to be doing. But there is kind of a conversation going back and forth. Shouldn't we do like rotating shifts? Like somebody come in from 6 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon, and somebody come in from 2 in the afternoon to 10 o'clock at night, or something like that. You know, These are ideas that people throw out instead of working Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or working week A, and then everybody else works Tuesday, Thursday, or week B, or something like that, where we're rotating out our work at home days. One of the things that I've seen, which I like the idea behind this, and I've seen this at happening at a few different locations. And the idea is this: work week A. We have half the people work week A. The other half of the people work week B. If you want to go into the office on week A or week B. And they set it up so that it's checkerboarded. So you will sit at seat one. Nobody sits at seat two. Your coworker sits at seat three. So you've got an empty desk between the two of you. And they checkerboard it. So across your desk, if you look forward on the other side of your monitors, there's nobody sitting there. There's somebody sitting at the next desk over across from desk two, which is the desk next to you. Follow me there? Just think about it. Basically, week A is on a checkerboard. It's all of the white squares. And week B is all of the black squares on the checkerboard. That idea actually works out pretty neat, because one of the things that they're doing with this is they clean the entire place every day, but then they get a chance to do a deep clean on the weekends. That means at any given point in time, very few people will be impacted, will be infected, will be getting COVID, getting this virus, which can really set us back. It's a lot better than us selecting, hey, I'm gonna go in on Tuesday. Oh, wait, Joe came in on Tuesday too. He sits next to me. Okay, well, it won't be all that bad. Yeah, it can be. By going with the assigned desks, by getting rid of the hoteling concept. I think I talked about this probably a year ago or so, the hoteling, where you come into the office, and when you come into the office, you check out a box, and you go and you take your box to the receptionist, and she goes, you're going to be at desk three. Hey, Mr. Johnson, you're going to be at desk four. Ms. Smith, you're going to be at desk five. And that doesn't work out as well, because you have to scrub all of those desks. Well, in this case, with this shifted week where you're week A or week B, everything gets clean. You get separation. You get that distancing that we actually do need to stay healthy. So do I think that we should rotate days? No, I think we should rotate weeks. I'm a fan of this concept. I'm a fan of the work from anywhere concept, and I'm a fan of the idea that we can move away from being in the same office all the time. And this is spreading throughout many industries, especially the IT industry. I welcome your thoughts on this. I welcome your feedback as to how you're experiencing all of this. Again, contact me here through the show. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. There are three basic functions I run through at the end of each day. Call it daily maintenance. The first is backup of all essential data that has been modified or added at the end of day. At the end of each week, I consolidate and backup only the active files I want to keep. A great bulk of the data is discarded at the end of the week. I have been using CCleaner to clean up unwanted or junk files. And I've been using Free Registry to clean up and tidy up the Windows registry to enable it to run efficiently and to help applications run without a hitch. People have often asked me, what's the registry? Think of the registry as a database of operating parameters for each application. On every Windows PC, the registry stores preferences and settings for applications and the Windows operating system itself. Windows does a good job of keeping the registry up to date, but it doesn't tidy up after itself very well. Over time, as you install and uninstall applications, the registry can become littered with old entries. These can cause error messages and slow the computer down. If you want to ensure that your PC functions correctly and remains fast, you need to clean it up. I do it at least once a day. I have run with other products, but find that many, in their quest to claim they clean up the most unwanted files and registries, have also generated false positives. With CClean and using Free Registry Cleaner, they may not have caught 100% of unwanted files and register settings. They have not generated false positives that waste a lot of my time to fix. Microsoft last week had issued a warning. Microsoft Defender warns that CCleaner is a potentially unwanted application, and here's why. If you have tried to install the Windows Cleanup utility CCleaner recently, you may have noticed that Microsoft Defender springs into action, warning you that it is a potentially unwanted application. This is not the first time Piriform CCleaner has gotten onto the wrong side of Microsoft. It was previously blocked from being mentioned in the Microsoft community forums. The AVAS-owned software has been popular with people seeking to clean up and optimize Windows 10 for a number of years. So what's going on, and why does Microsoft flag it as a PUA, or potentially unwanted application? The problem stems from the fact that there are multiple installers available for CCleaner, and not all of them are without baggage. Many of them include optional software such as browsers, toolbars, and antivirus tools, and this is giving Microsoft cause for concern. Over on the Microsoft Security Intelligence site, the company fully explains the reason for flagging up the popular software. Certain installers for free and 14-day trial versions of CCleaner comes with bundled applications, including applications that are not required by CCleaner or produced by the same publisher, Piriform. While the bundled applications themselves are legitimate, bundling of software, especially products from other providers, can result in unexpected software activity that can negatively impact user experience. To protect Windows users, Microsoft Defender Antivirus detects CCleaner installers that exhibit this behavior as potentially unwanted applications. The installers detected as PUA include CCleaner installers that have been found bundling the following applications. Note that these are normal applications that are not detected by Microsoft Defender Antivirus: Google Chrome, Google Toolbar, AVAS Free Antivirus, and AVG Antivirus Free. While the CCleaner installers do provide an option to opt out, some users can easily inadvertently install these bundled applications. Microsoft points out that it is possible for AVAS Free Antivirus to be downloaded and installed in the background, and the software can result in Microsoft Defender being disabled, which is something, of course, Microsoft as a company is obviously not keen on. I know in one case, in the accidental downloading, it downloaded an antivirus program, and when there are more than one antivirus programs installed, they don't run well together. And one of the causes I found was that it inhibited the wireless adapter to properly be disabled. A candidate for recycling your doorstop system. I remember back in the late 1970s, I purchased a 5 1/4-inch floppy diskette drive made by Micropolis. The cost was an unbelievable $958. However, the build, the design, and the quality of the drive was something that you would hold in awe. It was superb. I had never seen an electronic device using zero-ohm resistors. Instead of using a plain wire, they used a resistor color-coded black, black, black gold. For you modern-day electronic engineers, you probably never heard of a zero-ohm resistor with a tolerance of 5%. However, within a year, it was obsolete, but I held on to the drive for many years because of the initial cost, and it was emotionally difficult to send the drive to the recycle center. I also have other equipment that became part of my doorstop collection. If I were able to just give it away to someone who would accept it, it would have cleared up much of my guilt emotions. Today, it's a fact of life that downloading anything on the internet has to be done with great caution. It wasn't that long ago you were asked first if you wanted the extra program that came along with what you requested. Then it got trickier when the question was structured as a double negative, which meant yes. An example of this was, do you not want to not have the software download in question? Of course, with a double negative, it meant yes. It was only recent it became much more brazen. You get the extra software whether you want it or not. Now I have found a useful life cycle for my collection of doorstop systems that I can't give away. I recently converted a ThinkPad T20, originally equipped with a Pentium 3, 256 MB of RAM, and 40 GB of hard disk storage. I could not expand the RAM beyond 256 MB. The Model T20 ThinkPad was solidly built. It had been running Windows 98. We don't see the build quality of such a unit today. Instead of tossing it into the garbage heap, I downloaded a Linux distro and used it for download files from the internet. If there were any rogue files also downloaded, it cannot infect or corrupt my files on my regular systems. There are many Linux distros that are regularly supported and distributed that will run on a ThinkPad T20 with that limited memory. If the operating system of that Linux distro ever gets corrupted, the reload of an updated copy of the Linux distro is measured in minutes, not in hours. If you don't have any old PC systems designated as a doorstop, no problem. Just ask a fellow hobbyist and you will find many that will be happy to accommodate you with their trash, or at least what they consider trash, that they can't part with that can now be your treasure. Just a footnote. I did have an opportunity to visit the Micropolis factory when they were in business. In the early days, insertion of component parts and soldering them in place was a manual task. Today we have wave soldering that expedites the process. So when I asked them why they were using zero-ohm resistors, I had a simple answer. They found using the zero-ohm resistor in place of a very short wire that had to be cut to size was quicker. And here I thought they had a special reason to have a short circuit connection between two points. They did have a method to their madness. Presenting Marty Winston with his all hands on tech, with his no-touch tools at work.
If you're old enough to remember that Jack Benny was 39 years old for most of his life, then you may be old enough to remember when the Personal Computer Radio Show first came on the air. Here's a hint. Tonight, it begins its 38th year. Thanks and congratulations to the tireless Hank Key, the always inspirational Joe King, and to the many guests, fans, and supporters over the years. In celebration of this anniversary, tonight's show will not be asking for listener donations. It escaped that corner of purgatory last year, and hey, thank you for escaping with us. Meanwhile, back on topic. There's a surprising number of tools out there that do their work without touching anything. All the more surprising because the tools they're replacing always had to touch things. Not everything. There's still nothing to levitate lumber so you can cut it without a sawhorse. Many screwdrivers have motors, but they still touch the screws. No sonic screwdrivers at Lowe's or Home Depot just yet. But think about it. The fictional sonic screwdriver is even older than this show because that show started airing even earlier. And even before that, decades before that, the first not-touching tools were already in use. They were based on magnets, like the inexpensive stud finders made by putting a magnet on a pivot in a frame so as it passed over a nail head, it would swing in that direction and point to it. Today's stud finders can do a lot more. They can detect different kinds of materials on the other side of a wall, from fastening hardware to the wood and the studs themselves, plus pipes and wires that are connected to power. It's not quite X-ray vision, but there's a little of that, too. It's a product called Wallabot, W-A-L-A-B-O-T, and it's radioactive. Make that two words, radio and active, meaning it scans the radio frequencies to find signals that are all around us, TV, radio, cell towers, Wi-Fi, whatever is there. It's a kind of RF backscatter imaging called ambient backscatter. Ambient, because it's using whatever signals are already there. It's not the highest resolution you could ever wish for, but it's an image based on real things inside the wall. Now, if you're willing to touch the wall, even just a little, to poke a small hole, you can see in color and decent resolution by using what some call a snake camera or a snorkel camera or a borescope camera or an endoscope camera. These days, they also offer miniature headlights that, in concert with some already good sensitivity, well, it makes for an interesting video. Okay, so maybe a hole in the wall is cheating. There's no cheating with thermal imagers because they see heat, and the shapes and colors they show are depicting temperatures. Behind walls, sure, there could be a wiring fault that creates heat or a hot water leak, but thermal imaging is also very useful when examining ventilation ducts, fireplaces, window or door seals, attic spaces, or roofing. And now, you're absolutely not touching things that you once had to touch to determine if they felt a little too hot or a little too cold. Don't burn your fingers. Thermal imaging is also a great way to know exactly where you want to measure temperatures more precisely. Touching those places is less than precise and could hurt. They do make thermometers for that. You just take your thermometer to the point, touch it, and take a reading. Depending on where it is, you might need a ladder to reach it, or don't touch it. Remote reading infrared thermometers are all over the place, and not just the ones you see in the pandemic spam. Tool-grade infrared remote read thermometers are very precise over a long range, and many include a laser dot to help you aim. Some include more than one laser dot. Know why? Those measurements don't steer themselves, and they're only accurate within a limited beam angle, and that can lead to mistakes. If you're too far away, you might be trying to take the temperature of a half-inch pipe, but you end up taking the average temperature of a 3-foot circle. The remote read thermometers with multiple dots help you frame the measurement to locate it precisely, even down to within the profile of the pipe. Thanks to the infrared and thanks to the lasers, you get the reading you need without having to touch a thermometer there. Lasers are all over the place. Laser pointers help work crews show each other where work needs doing. Some saws project laser lines along their cut lines. Some drill presses put a laser dot where the bit will go into the material. Some levels have lasers in them, so once you get that bubble in the middle, you can extend that line over several yards. But that's just the beginning. There are self-leveling lasers that can cast lines. Many can cast vertical, horizontal, and transverse lines at the same time, gridding out into three dimensions. It can look like the grid you see on an empty holodeck on Star Trek. Some have up and down vertical plumb dots, so the starting point positioning stays precise. Some can even project hash marks along lines to help with tasks like positioning studs for framing, or frames for drop ceilings, or layouts for flooring. All that used to take tape measures and chalk lines and hanging plumb lines and rulers and squares and a lot of time and a lot of things touching other things all over the place just to get the line straight in any one direction, square in any two directions, and consistent across three. Don't you just love it when tech lets you be both more precise and a little bit lazier? Another way to get lazier with a laser is LiDAR. Remember what LiDAR is? It's like radar or sonar, only done with light instead of with microwaves or sound. You time a bounce, a reflection. With LiDAR, you literally measure the time of flight of laser light between where you are and where its dot hits. So there are laser distance measurers everywhere. Even pocket-sized ones where the distance measurements are only one of the sets of functions. Back to that in a moment. You're not running tape measures, or measuring sticks, or even rulers. You don't have to travel to where the dot is and touch something. You just measure. By the way, the first no-touch measuring tools use two other technologies. One of those is ultrasonics. It's a cousin of sonar called sodar. Sonar happens in water, and sodar happens in air. With ultrasonic distance measurements, you need a clear path. A carton on the floor between you and what you want as your distant target is enough to get the sound to bounce. And you get a precise measurement, not of the distance to your target, but of the distance to the carton. Lasers and LiDAR don't have that problem. The other technology is optics. You look through a viewfinder and adjust the focus until the image is sharp and a readout gives you the distance. You still see a lot of those on golf courses. How can you tell if an electrical wire is connected to power? The classic way is to touch it with a pair of insulated meter probes and take a reading, and there are now no-touch tools for that, too. The simplest are non-contact, live-voltage sensors that light an LED or beep when they're near live wires. It's a fast, simple, dead-or-alive reading. Most are for typical household AC use, but some cover multiple ranges. If they're reading power line voltages, they're also pretty useful for detecting breaks in a line. Remember the pocket-sized distance measurement tool where that was only one of its functions? That was in combination with a non-contact voltage sensor. Having them both was really handy while the basement cabling here got expanded. Now, more than 100 total outlets. Finally, you don't have to get wet when you use humidity sensors to help find leaks in roofs or walls or, for that matter, pipes. And now you're in touch with lots of different kinds of tools that can do their work without actually touching their work. Next time, with one eye on the weather and the other on the power lines, it's a good time to get into the abrupt destruction that can follow electrical events, and not just those that the utility put there. The real point is what you can do about them to prevent them, to defend against them, and if they happen anyway, to find out what went wrong and what you can do about it. Let's call that episode Surge and Rescue. At times, it can be a shocker.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Some of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For update information, visit the website of the Computer Club, and if you're interested in the subject itself, RSVP so you can get a meeting ID. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting Thursday, August the 13th at 7 p.m. The topic of presentation is How to Set Up RetroPie on the Raspberry Pi. RSVP at nyacc.org if you're interested for a Zoom meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 11th, and their meeting time is 8 p.m. via Amazon Chime. For more information on how to get onto Amazon, RSVP to acgnj.org for more information on how you can participate via Amazon Chime. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on PRN.FM on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send me an email addressed to Hank at PCRadioShow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do your regular backups on your computer. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for your support. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.